pick up where we left off last time. We finished the first four verses of of 2 Peter chapter 2 in the hour that we spent together last month. So it's hard not to do at least a small recap to connect it to what we'll cover today. So remember, Peter's talking about at the beginning of chapter 2 that there were false prophets back in Israel among God's people. And he said, don't be surprised. In fact, expect that there will be false teachers amongst the church today as well. And that they will bring in destructive heresy and false teaching and cause all kinds of problems along the way. And of course, we also mentioned that even though we know that there are false teachers, we want to be reminded that there are false brethren as well. So if you start ragging on teachers and it's all these ministers that are the problem, well, remember that the Bible also talks about false brethren as well. And I'm sure we've all caused all kinds of problems, whether false teachers or false brethren. But again, as we said, it's often Satan's mode of operation to try to attack the leadership, because if he sours the leadership or leads them astray, they're able to affect a lot more people than possibly one who's a part of the congregation. But again, I've seen situations many years ago and in other areas that you may have been familiar with as well. You get somebody with a sour attitude, and it can. A member can affect many, many other members with a lousy attitude. So it's not just false teachers that are the problem. But that's what Peter's talking about here. There's going to be false teachers. He's warning them that they will come. And then he reminds them that God will act. God will act to remove and to punish those who teach incorrectly, who lead people astray, who cause difficulties or destruction along the way. And then he started into, as we went through last time, three examples to show that even though it may not look like it on the surface, I can give you three solid examples that prove beyond any shadow of doubt that God will deal with the false teachers. And so we went through the first example last time that he used to show beyond any shadow of doubt punishment will come to those who deserve it. So he said, look, if God did not deal with the angels who sinned, so he went through the whole concept of the angels who sinned, but that's the point. What makes us think God wouldn't step in to deal with false teachers if he dealt with the angels? And then he goes on to the second example. That's where we'll pick it up today. And that's down in verse 5. The second example that God will deal with the false teachers, even though it may not seem like on the surface it's happening very quickly or very speedily. Verse 5, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood of the world of the ungodly, on the world of the ungodly. So the second example that proves God will step in is the flood during Noah's time. Now you ask the question, how long did God allow the world to go on before finally stepping in and acting? And again, when we say God will act speedily, Noah's flood is one of those great examples. That, what do you mean speedily? How many hundreds of years went on with the world in a complete mess? Well, we know clearly that the last 120 years went on when God already said, I'm going to destroy it. I'm going to flood it. So he got Noah started on this ark that takes 120 years to build before he steps in. But when he stepped in, compare that 40 days of rain with 1,500 years of human history, where humans are going completely the wrong direction. Boy, you compare that, and that's speedy intervention. Didn't take 120 years to flood the earth. It took about, 15 days probably before people are climbing, if they could climb at all, to the tops of the highest mountains. And again, we should at least mention Genesis chapter 6. Maybe we could take a quick turn there. Genesis chapter 6. I'll put my 3x5 here in 2 Peter. Genesis chapter 6 in verses 5 through 8. So again, why is Peter bringing this up? to tell us that, look, it may not look like God is keeping track. It may not look like people are going to have to pay for their sins. But trust me, he's saying, since God dealt with the angels, since God dealt with the ancient world, you can trust that God will deal with false teachers when the time is right. Genesis 6 and verse 5. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth. How many decades, how many centuries did that take to happen? A long time, probably. And that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Everything self-focused. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth and was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I'll destroy man whom I've created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. I don't think we want to make God that sorry again. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. And it says, of course, in verse 9, why? He walked perfectly before God. So, God did not spare the ancient world. What is interesting, if we go back to Peter, we can ask a couple questions. If you read some things about why some people refuse to believe in God, Noah's flood is one of them from several aspects. From one aspect, they don't think it could ever happen. You know how much water there would have to be to cover Mount Everest? Well, you see, there's several, maybe we take just a minute to digress. There are several assumptions made when people say things like, do you know how much water it would take to flood the entire earth to the height of 30,000 feet? And they basically want to say there's not much that much water on the earth. It couldn't happen. So they discount the flood being a worldwide event. Well, one of the assumptions they make is that Mount Everest was at its current height when the time of Noah's flood came. Well, that's an assumption you can't make. When God says he opens up the deep and he cracks the earth open, and it floods from underneath, it floods from the top, it rains for 40 days, but it says the waters of the deep are opened up. How does that happen? Does God just take the whole land mass and compress it a little bit so that the current oceans flood most of the land? Well, God could easily do that. So again, with man, these things are impossible. It is literally impossible to say there's enough water on the earth to flood the entire surface of the earth to 30,000 feet. That is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. God could have done that a number of ways. So when you start with the attitude of faith, this is what God says, I wonder how he did that, as opposed to, that's what the Bible says, you can't trust that. It's a completely different approach. In theology, it's called the hermeneutics of trust. That means you look at the Bible, you trust that it's true, and then you try to understand how it could be true. Whereas the hermeneutics of distrust is you can't trust this, let's prove it wrong. So God could very easily compress the surface of the earth just slightly. I mean, you take an ice cube and you push it down in the water, what happens? It gets covered with water pretty quickly, doesn't it? Could God easily do that to the continents? In a heartbeat. He created the universe. Can he push the continents down just a little bit? Now, what evidence would there be that the continents were pushed down in that glass of water? Well, none. You know, when you push that ice cube down in the water, it comes back up. What evidence is there that it was underwater for a little while? Well, none. So people say, well, there's no evidence that this... Okay, let's not get off on Noah's flood. Bottom line is, God can easily do these things. His point here is... I should say one other thing. That's one of the things that Noah's flood always comes under controversy with. The second one is, how could a God of love just drown millions of people? I'm not going to worship a God like that. That's a fantasy. That's a joke. Okay. There's, again, a number of assumptions that are made in something like this. Number one is those people deserve to live. That's an assumption you can't make. If the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually, and violence had spread around the earth, would you like the entire earth filled with Nazi Germany? And say, oh, it would be terrible to kill those people. I mean, who's the guy that presses the button on the gas chamber? Does that guy deserve to live when he has deliberately poisoned, gassed hundreds of people to death? Again, that's an extreme example. But you understand the point. You're making the assumption that these people were so nice they deserve to live. Well, God says the opposite. Now, some probably were just normal, everyday people. So God's making an example. The second assumption they don't understand is the second resurrection. God's going to resurrect every single one of those people. So yeah, he ended their physical life, but it's his prerogative. He owns life. So he can start it and stop it whenever he likes. So those people are going to come up in a resurrection. So to say, I would never worship a God who's just killed people like this, say, well, is there a reason? You know, can you think this through a little bit? So those major accusations against God really are unfounded. God could easily flood the earth to the top of Mount Everest if he wanted to. Just push the ice cube down in the water a little bit. I mean, they'll say, right? The earth is molten lava inside. That means all the crusts, what? They float. And they'll admit that. They float. That's why you have these earthquakes, because these tectonic plates are floating. And can God just push them down a little bit if he wanted to? Of course he could. So those two major exceptions are pretty easily explained when you really look at it. Again, it's a matter of trust in what God says as opposed to distrust in what God says. So God was not unjust. It was in fact an act of love to drown those people. By not allowing them to live any longer, they did not continue to degrade their character. And the horrible influence of that world was removed so that a fresh start could be made. And these people are going to come up in a much better world than they went down in and be able to learn God's way. So God was not unjust by drowning the world at that time. But again, Peter's point is, God's going to deal with people. God keeps track. He understands these things. Now, when it says here in 2 Peter, in verse 5, but save Noah, one of eight people, you'll notice if you have certain translations, the words one of and people are all in italics, which means they aren't in the original Greek. They're added to try to help us understand. So the way the New American, or I should say the New King James translators took this, King James translators a little bit differently, but the way they looked at it is that there were eight people saved in the ark. It was Noah and his three sons and their three daughters and his wife. So eight people altogether. So they're interpreting this to say, oh, he was one of eight. But what did we just read back in Genesis? It says Noah only. He was the only one that found favor or grace in God's eyes. So there's another way to look at that phrase where it says God saved Noah the eighth, or number eight. And that may be a reference to when you go through from Genesis, what, 4 or 5, the lineage from Adam onward. You've got basically one righteous individual, it seems, in each generation along the way. So it says Noah was righteous in his generation. He was the only one at that time. So it seems that there was always one individual that God worked with. You had Seth early on. Then you have Enoch. Each of these different individuals in each generation. So when you look at that, Noah is about the eighth one listed. So that may be what Peter was referring to, that he was the eighth in a line of righteous men that ended, of course, at the flood. So that's an interesting thought. Not a big deal doctrinally, to say the least. It may be just saying one of eight. He was one of eight on the boat, but more likely he was that eighth one in the genealogy, in the lineage of righteous people. All right, so after these two examples, look, God let the world go on for a long time, but he did act. He gave a great deal of mercy, gave a great deal of rope, as we say, to hang ourselves before he stepped in. But he always steps in. He keeps track of these things. So then Peter gives the third example. He's trying to encourage the brethren. I know it looks like false teachers are getting away with this stuff, and it'll certainly seem like that when you're beaten up by these people, but trust me, God knows. Keep doing what's right. Don't give in to it. Verse 6 is third example. That God will act at the appropriate time. Verse 6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes. Condemn them to destruction, making them an example to those afterward who would live ungodly. So again, this is all in the context of he'll step in, he'll take care of things at the right time. So Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 18. Again, a pretty obvious example. And again, we should at least mention that as we look at each of these examples. Each of these examples was a once-in-history occurrence. As far as we know, there have been no other cities that have had fire and brimstone rained down upon them from God as a punishment for what they're like. And yet, there have been any number of cities equally as evil as Sodom and Gomorrah over the centuries of human existence. So why doesn't God do it all the time? That's often a question people outside the church ask as well. Well, if God is really God, yeah, he'll destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, but why not New York or Los Angeles or Shanghai or whatever city you might name that might be just as evil as Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, God does these things for examples. His job at this point is not to intervene on every piece of evil on the earth. He's done it enough times for us to know he's going to do it. But it's just not his purpose right now to control mankind in that way. Now, is he going to rain fire and brimstone down? Well, you look at those plagues in Revelation, the seven trumpet plagues and the seven last plagues, and it's worse than fire and brimstone raining down on the earth. So God will intervene. Trust that he will. Genesis 18 and verse 20. The Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, and we'll see that it's not just sexual sins that were the problem here, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. If not, I will know. So as you remember, he sends the one who would become Christ, apparently, down to literally see what's going on with his two angelic cohorts, and they find that it is as sick as it has been reported to be. Turn over to Ezekiel in chapter 16. Ezekiel 16 is talking about Jerusalem. And then it compares it to Sodom and Gomorrah, or at least to Sodom, not Gomorrah specifically, but since we always mention Sodom and Gomorrah together, you kind of throw them together. Specifically, it says about Sodom here. And again, we mentioned obviously that the end result of their attitude and approach is this sexual perversion that they were involved in. But that was not the only thing. In Ezekiel 16 and verse 48, Ezekiel 16 and verse 48. God again is talking about Jerusalem and said, you've become just as bad as Samaria, you've become just as bad, worse than Babylon, worse than all these other areas. But then he brings up Sodom specifically. Verse 48, as I live, says the Eternal God, neither your sister Sodom nor her daughters, which obviously would be Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain. They were not the only two cities God destroyed. There were a bunch of cities on the plain that God destroyed. Sodom and Gomorrah are the only ones named. So Sodom nor her daughters have done as you and your daughters have done. Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride. So pride was the initial sin that led to the sexual sins that were eventually characteristic of the area. Now, to me, it's instructive that in our culture today, we have what day? Pride Day. Isn't that interesting? That's what it's called out there in the world, that you take pride in this sexual deviation, this perversion that goes on. Interesting that it's called that. She had pride. Fullness of food. In other words, you got spare time, abundance of idleness, plenty to eat, plenty of time on your hands, and when you're full of pride, you go in directions you ought not go. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy, and they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore I took them away as I saw fit. And some translations render that, I took them away when I saw it. And that's when he had come down and actually looked at it, to see it. So again, in this situation, Sodom and Gomorrah stand as an example that God will intervene. Pride is the primary problem, the very problem that caused Lucifer's downfall, Satan's downfall. And then it leads to all these other things. I can do what I want. You can't tell me what to do. If I want to, you know, have sex with whatever, it's my opinion, it's my choice. You have no say in this. So you get this again. Instead of God tell me what I ought to be doing, it's I can do what I want. You don't tell me what to do. So let's go back to 2 Peter. If we learn from these three examples, obviously we learn there are consequences for living the way of sin. And these false teachers will have to pay. And again, we could say false teachers. We tend to think of that in the church context. But there are false teachers of all kinds out there, just leading people astray in so many ways. But God hears that. He sees that. He will step in and deal with all that. Verse 7 continues the Sodom and Gomorrah story. God delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. He's called here Righteous Lot. Now, when we read the story of Lot, we probably don't first think of the word righteous. We think of what happened with his daughters, that they got him drunk and they slept with him. Again, they thought that the world had come to an end. They saw everything that they were familiar with and knew about go up in flames, the whole valley on fire. They're up on this little rise in this little city, and they see everything that they ever knew is destroyed. So they're hiding up there. In the mountains. So they thought they were the only ones. So you can't blame them. I mean, it was a pretty sick approach, but we understand. Again, different culture, different society than we have now. Remember, Abraham married his sister. His only was half-sister, but it was acceptable at that time. We think of sleeping with your father as ghastly. Obviously, today we would. And yet, in spite of his sins, which I assume he apparently deeply repented of at some point, the overall judgment of his life, according to Peter, he was righteous Lot. Indicates God's love for him because he spared him. God went to Sodom, and these angels pulled Lot out of the city. And he was righteous. Yeah, he sinned, absolutely, but he was righteous. How do we know that? Well, what did Abraham ask before the whole thing took place? God, would you spare the city if there were 50 righteous there? 50 righteous. So there's somebody righteous there. And of course, you know, it got down to 10, and Abraham quit asking. He was hoping there were 9 more beside his nephew. There wasn't. So God pulled righteous Lot out, which also shows us righteousness is not equal to perfection while we're in the flesh. Now, when we're in the spirit, yes. But righteousness, we can be a righteous person and still make mistakes. Now, we can be a righteous person who sins. I mean, that's what Lot was in the situation of. He was a righteous person who sinned, made mistakes. Now, does that give ourselves an excuse? Oh, well, we can sin then and still be righteous. Well, no, that's not the point. Point is, when we do something stupid, we make mistakes, we can recover. We can repent. We can ask God's forgiveness. We pick up and go in the right direction, much like David did. David was a righteous man who did foolish things on occasion. The thing with Bathsheba was foolishness. He made a mistake. He got weak. He got messed up. But it didn't disqualify him, because when it was brought to, came to his senses, he repented. So that's a helpful thing as we go through the story of Lot there. So he was righteous, and it says again in verse 6, verse 6, making an example of verse 7, delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. And I would say that's much like the situation we're in today, where we see the wicked all around us, and we're not throwing stones at them, but we see a culture that is just sick. It's constantly moving in the wrong direction. So it must have been a constant sorrow to Lot, like it is a constant sorrow to us, to see the conduct of people around us, to see how foolish and where they just, as Christ said, as he looks over Jerusalem, they're sheep without a shepherd. These people just wandering around like with no direction, no real spiritual direction in their lives. So with that, I jotted down here one scripture I'd like to read with you. Ezekiel chapter 9. Ezekiel 9. So we're told that this righteous man was dwelling among the Sodomites, and he was tormented in his heart. He was tormented day to day, seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Well, I think, again, that's where we are. We can see just sad, sad circumstances, day after day, time after time, place after place. Ezekiel 9 and verse 1. He called out of my hearing with a loud voice, saying, "Let those who have charge over the city draw near, each with a deadly weapon in his hand." Now, interesting that Ezekiel gets this curtain raised, and here's this city, in this case, Jerusalem. And there are at least six individual spirit beings guarding the city. And so he calls out those who have charge over the city. So they're apparently, now maybe this is just an analogy or a story, but you wonder if it's not based in reality. Did the city have six very powerful angels in charge over the city to protect it, to make sure it stayed until the time that God said, okay, it's time to let it go? Nonetheless, each with a deadly weapon in his hand, verse 2, and suddenly six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his battle axe in his hand. One man among them was clothed with linen and had a writer's inkhorn at his side. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of the Lord, the God of Israel, had gone up from the cherub, where it had been, to the threshold of the temple. And he called the man clothed with linen, who had the writer's inkhorn at his side, and the Lord said to him, "Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it." And I hope that describes us. That we sigh and cry over what goes on in this world, the way people treat each other, the way they deal with each other, the immorality, the unfairness, the oppression. We have a messed up world, to say the least. But in this case, they're pictured. This one spirit being has this UV ink, and he marks their forehead. Obviously, very opposite from the mark of the beast in their right hand and their forehead. Very different than that. This is a mark that identifies God's people. So you might be seeing that kind of UV ink where you know, on your hand or on a sheet or something like that. And then you put the black light over it and it glows. You don't see it in regular light, but you put the black light on it and it's like those Velvet Elvis pictures. All of a sudden it comes to life, you know. That's the kind of mark that this angel places on these people at that time. So put a mark on the foreheads of those who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. To the others, he said in my hearing, go after him through the city and kill. So we got one angel marking, got the other five just slaughtering the people. Go through the city and kill. Do not let your eye spare, nor have pity. Utterly slay old and young, maidens and little children and women. But do not come near anyone on whom is the mark. And begin at my sanctuary. So they began with the elders who were before the temple. Now again, it's an interesting situation here. That Lot sighed and cried, we might say, for the abominations going on in Sodom. Now was he affected by living there? Apparently so. And his daughters certainly were. But nonetheless, he was a righteous individual crying about what was going on there. We should be individuals who sigh and cry about what goes on in our world. just the level of deception and misunderstanding and oppression and difficulty, poverty, just terrible things. So going back to 2 Peter, we hope that we have this mark upon us as well. That there is this UV marker spiritually that's upon our foreheads. So that we'll be spared when the time comes for this intervention. So verse 8 again. For that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Thought I might have jotted down another translation there. I don't have it. So let's go from there. Verse 9. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. So by examining Lot, he had the mark, we might say. So the angels went there, they yanked him out of the city. We look at Ezekiel. Those who have the mark, God spares. So in verse 8 or verse 9, Peter's saying God can take care of the righteous and protect them, and he can destroy or punish the ungodly. So God just doesn't intervene, smash everyone. He protects the righteous. Now the word temptations here, we should pause for a second. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. The word temptations is probably not the best translation of the word. Trial or difficulty might be a better way to translate that. Because when we think of the word temptation, we tend to think of we're being tempted by some immoral action or some sin that is appealing to us. It's not really what he's saying here. If you think of the word trial or test, that's probably more accurately what Peter's getting at. He knows how to deliver the godly out of tests or trials. Now, temptation sometimes is interchangeable there because it's when we're in those difficult trials that we're tempted sometimes. We're tempted to neglect prayer and study. We're tempted to give up on God. We're tempted to doubt. We're tempted to assume that God's not going to step in. Or we're tempted to give up or to give in. So they're interchangeable in some respects. But he'll reserve, deliver the godly out of these trials. And again, that's the context of we've got these false teachers. They've injected themselves into the church. They're causing all kinds of problems. They're bringing in destructive heresies. God knows how to protect you during that trial, deliver you out of that trial. So when it appears that the unrighteous are doing just fine and they're getting away with murder, remember, God is keeping track and has these unjust reserved for punishment. We have the mark that we just talked about, we hope, in Ezekiel 16. The others have the mark of the beast. And those are the ones that are set for destruction in the future. In verse 10 then, and especially those who walk according to the flesh, in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. Now again, remember the context is these false teachers that he began with in chapter 2. God is especially, or I should say Peter at least, probably God as well, is especially upset about false teachers. Those who appear to be a part of the church, who are supposed to be teaching righteousness, but are selfish and perverted and self-absorbed and greedy, and they take advantage of others. Again, you take advantage of others in the name of religion, it's particularly distasteful to God, it seems. And that's understandable. When it says they walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness, they were carnal and perverted. Now, it's a place like this where many biblical scholars will then say there had to be something that Peter was specifically addressing for him to put it in these terms. Because you normally don't think of religious false teachers just walking according to the flesh and the lust of uncleanness. you know, sexually perverted in some way, carnal. So what was he talking about? Well, it's very likely that the specific thing Peter may have been addressing, and again, the Bible is written in such a way that he can address specific issues at that day and they become principles for all time. And that's certainly the case here, if this is true. If Peter is writing about this early Gnostic thought, this development of thought, part of what the Gnostics thought is that, obviously we've talked about this before, that the flesh is dirty and filthy, the material creation is filthy and dirty, that God is so very, very righteous that he can have nothing to do with the creation. And we've also talked about then how Peter and John talk very much about Christ, no, the Creator came in the flesh. And we touched him. We held him. He has everything to do with the creation. He wants to save the creation. So very different than the Gnostic thought. So if physical is bad, and all we're worried about is the spirit, then what you do in your physical body doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Because what we're dealing with is the spirit. So that's all physical. That's all going to be done away with. So they're the ones that basically indulge the body, do whatever they want, whatever they think is feels good, do it kind of approach. So again, human nature doesn't change much, does it? We're in a generation today, or the zeitgeist of the comic, do what you want, do what feels good. You know, YOLO, you only live once. FOMO, fear of missing out. You know, you can't have that. Let's do all this stuff, you know. So human nature is the same as it has always been. But in this case, if Peter's addressing that specifically, that's how we get the concept that they're just out for themselves. They're walking according to the flesh. It doesn't matter who you sleep with, because the flesh doesn't matter. It's only the spirit. Now, of course, we all understand that's ridiculous. You can't do things in the physical without affecting your mind, without affecting your spirit, quote unquote. Can't do it. You can't separate the two. We are the spirit and man inside a physical body, and the two are very closely related. What we do in the body does have an effect on the spirit, without a doubt. The Gnostics separated those two things. So, you know, as Paul says later on in Corinthians, you know, do you just keep sinning so that God's graciousness forgives you and that makes God all the greater? He said, God forbid. Of course not. But that was kind of the Gnostic way of thinking. Well, the more I sin, the more I sleep around, the more I do these perverted things, the greater God is because he forgives me of those things. What a twisted way to think. So if Peter's writing about that, then we can understand how do you get teachers who walk according to the flesh and the lust of uncleanness, just carnal and perverted people? Well, that's how, when you think it doesn't matter. New American Standard renders that in verse 9. Or verse 10, I should say, especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and despise authority. Daring, self-willed, they do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties. Now again, exactly what Peter might have been addressing in his day, what specific things came up, it's hard to tell. We can only speculate like I just did about these Gnostic teachings. But it is interesting, you see several characteristics about these individuals who have rejected God's authority and taken it on for themselves, these false teachers. Remember we talked about they have their own opinions and that becomes the doctrine along the way. So there's an attitude that goes along with this that he identifies here. He says in the King James, they despise authority. King James says dominion. Is there not, in as we said in Sodom, this issue of pride? And one of the basic aspects of pride is nobody's going to tell me what to do. My opinion is just as good as anybody else's. I decide for myself what is right and what is wrong. There's this aspect of pride that rejects authority. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. And again, we've had people that, sadly, because they've been hurt, they walk away from the church. I don't want anybody over me. They try to make believe that there is no authority in the church. Well, that's not true. Just because authority has been misused, because there have been false teachers, doesn't mean that it's not true. I mean, that there is an authority, that there isn't responsibility in the church. So in this case, they despise authority. And you'll often see that kind of approach through the years in various situations that there's an issue with authority. Now again, literally, if the word authority can be the word dominion or dominions. And it could refer specifically to angels, because the word dominion is several times in the New Testament used to describe angels. Christ created these dominions and principalities, and he's referring to angelic beings. So it could be that when Peter writes about this, they despise dominions, authority, angels. Again, it's hard for some of the Gnostic teaching to know where angels really fit in the whole scheme of their thinking. Some would say you have to go through angels to get to God eventually. Hard to say exactly what Peter might have been addressing there. But when it says they despise authority, kurios is the Greek word. And it literally means dominion or power or authority or lordship. They don't want anybody over them. And again, when you come down to Satan's basic attitude, what was it? God's not going to tell me what to do. I don't want anybody over me. I'm going to be the one in charge. So anytime we feel that kind of approach, we realize that's probably not a godly approach. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I don't want anybody over me. He's not over me. She's not over me. I'm not going to submit. There's probably an issue there. So they despise authority. They are presumptuous, another characteristic of Satan the devil. Self-willed, want it their own way. They're not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries. And again, King James and New King James tries to do the best they can with that word dignitaries. Literally, the literal Greek is glorious ones. Glorious ones. So again, is he referring to this Gnostic thinking and these angels and not angels? And how does it all work together? But regardless, they were speaking evil either of dignitaries in the church or glorious ones in the church. Or they were speaking disrespectfully toward God's created realm, the angelic realm in some way. Nonetheless, obviously, we're told in Titus 3, verses 1 and 2, Verse 2, speak evil of no one. Titus 3, 2. Speak evil of no one. So regardless of whether Peter was talking about, they just disrespect God's created order of God, angels, and then humans, and how all that fits together, or whether they're literally speaking evil of glorious ones, in other words, the ones that God had set up in the church to see, to serve the church, to oversee the church. Whatever he's talking about, we're told not to speak evil of anybody. So clear, regardless of exactly what Peter might have been intending, we steer clear of speaking evil of anybody. Verse 11, again, continues this angelic theme. Whereas angels, so again, our dominions and dignitaries, all speaking about angels, pretty possible. Whereas angels, obviously referring to righteous angels, who are greater in power in might, greater in power and might than these false teachers, these self-willed, presumptuous individuals, do not bring a reviling accusation against them before the Lord. I like the way the New American Standard translates this verse. I think it's a little clearer. Whereas angels, who are greater in might and power, do not bring a reviling judgment against themselves before the Lord. So what Peter seems to be indicating is you have these puny humans speaking disrespectfully of God, speaking disrespectfully of God's created order, speaking disrespectfully of authority, maybe in the church, of offices in the church. And then he compares that to righteous angels who won't even bring a railing accusation or reviling accusation against the fallen angels. It's not time yet. Against them, themselves. That seems to be the indication here. So you have righteous angels who realize that final judgment is not in their hands. Whose hands is it in? Well, 1 Corinthians 6 talks, or 2 Corinthians 6 talks about us having that responsibility. Paul says, "Don't know you not, you shall judge angels?" And then he says, are you not capable of judging the simplest matters in the church? You know, he's kind of he's kind of slapping the Corinthians on the hand, saying, come on, you can't get along with each other. How are you going to judge angels if you can't sort out these little difficulties you have in the church? I wish it were that easy, sorting out these little difficulties. But it isn't. It's pretty challenging sometimes. So he's saying angels, righteous angels, don't bring accusations about the fallen spirits. It's not their job. It's not their time. It's not their responsibility to judge those angels yet. So they don't go before God and bring these reviling accusations. And remember we said before that Satan's spirit is a spirit of accusation, of accusing others, pointing out faults, pointing out troubles. The righteous angels apparently leave that in God's hands. They don't bring railing accusations against the others. If we continue on from there in verse 12, but these, in other words, referring back to these self-willed, presumptuous, false teachers who aren't afraid to speak evil of glories or dignities or dominions, in other words, in the church or in the spirit world, these false people, like natural brute beasts, made to be caught and destroyed. In other words, he just likens these people to just animals. They're like animals. They speak evil of things they do not understand. So again, I doubt that they understood government in the church. That would have been an issue. But more likely, they don't understand God's created order. And that's what they're speaking evil about. They do not understand and will utterly perish in their own corruption. Utterly perish in their own corruption. Let me read that to you in the New American Standard. Verse 12, but these, like unreasoning animals, born as creatures of instinct to be captured and killed. That's a pretty strong statement about these false teachers. They're just like brute beasts. That's the way New King James says, these brute beasts, just like beasts of the field. Now there's a couple things that are interesting spin-offs from this verse. And one is, there are reasons on occasion to kill beasts. There are those in the culture today that any kind of killing of an animal is seen as a terrible thing, something not to be done. I've heard of others recently who at a church building, actually, it became a religious thing. They had a problem with mice, so they would live trap these field mice that came into the church, and then take them outside and let them go, because they didn't want to destroy a life. Okay, I can understand that. I don't want to make fun of that dramatically. At the same time, I'd like mice out in the field, not in my buildings. So I have traps and I kill them. Because I don't want them multiplying inside. Last year when we went to FI for 3 weeks, we had mice move into our home, and came upstairs when we got back, and Pam had this beautiful fluffy white bath mat in the bathroom, and one corner of it was completely gone. Like, what happened to this? It's like there's a fire or something. Well, these little mice had gotten there, and this is nice. They liked the bath mat just as much as Pam did, apparently. And they took half of it away to their bathroom before we killed them all. And that's not to make fun of life. I mean, life is precious. At the same time, it's to be managed. The half dozen mice that I, you know, snap in traps in my house have not hurt the world population of mice. You know, they still do pretty well out there where they live. They don't need to be in my house. Sometimes it's important to recognize that there were, for example, beasts that kill people, destroy crops. What is made in God's image? Well, people are made in God's image. Cows are not made in God's image. I mean, they're nice. We love them. We love to eat them. Love to drink their milk. Love to have butter from them. But they're not people. They're not made in God's image. Humans are. So those things not made in God's image are to be managed and dealt with. That doesn't mean you just ridiculously kill things. I mean, the slaughter of the bison in America was a terrible sin. It was just terrible. Slaughtering these animals, just leaving mountains, literally, of carcasses to rot. I mean, it was terrible. So just the whole outright slaughter is ridiculous. But managing for the good of the people, for the environment, for food, for all those things, is certainly a reasonable thing to do. There are some that are very dangerous, obviously, to human beings, and may need to be managed in a little bit more careful way. In other words, gotten rid of. I don't know that anyone would say, you know, I think I probably should have a den of rattlesnakes in my backyard just to keep the bugs down. Other ways to do that. So you wonder sometimes if God has placed some of these quote-unquote brute beasts there to teach us a lesson, that sometimes things are evil and need to be gotten rid of. And sometimes that's manifested in the creation as well. Now again, it's interesting that people might take this view toward animals. You never kill an animal because they're part of the great balance of nature. But would they say the same things about viruses or about bacteria? Those are living things as well. How dare you kill a bacteria with an antibiotic or some other natural means, because this is a living thing you're just putting to death? Well, it doesn't usually go that far, but sadly, many of the same people who claim that you can never kill an animal have no qualms about aborting babies. And you think, how can this be the case? You know, I'm saving the whales on one hand, but I'm killing babies on the other hand. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. So again, it's this sad situation that we see in the culture around us. So angels, these verse 12 again, like natural brute beasts, are made to be caught and destroyed, and they speak evil of things they do not understand, and will utterly perish in their own corruption. We get what we deserve, and that's what his point is. They're going to perish in their own corruption. They brought this upon themselves. God is just going to give them what they deserve. So again, there'll be a chance for them to be resurrected, of course, and taught the way of life and change. Taught God's way of life and change. One final thing then before we close. It's interesting that he says they speak evil of things they do not understand. It is quite easy to do that. To speak evil of things we don't understand. People we don't understand, situations we don't understand. I think it is imperative upon us to take the time to try to understand. You know, what is Stephen Covey's, one of his laws of success, seven laws of highly effective people, is seek to understand rather than to be understood. You know, so many times we want to be understood. One of his rules, I think, is reasonable. Seek first to understand. Try to understand, why is a person thinking this way? Why are they talking this way? What are they doing? What's going on? Why would this decision be made? It's so easy, for me at least, to criticize a decision with having no background about why the decision might have been made. And assume that I know something about it that I don't know at all. I don't want to be like a natural brute beast made to be killed and destroyed by speaking evil about something I don't understand. And you may have done that. Well, if the boss, I don't understand why they don't. I think we may have mentioned, I don't think it's posted just yet. I'm hoping it will be shortly. But we sat and talked about things that we wanted to cover at the Winter Family Weekend with the young adults. And one of the ones I was really looking forward to covering was, the topic was, what I'll do when I'm in charge. And Mr. Kyler liked that title so much, he took it. So, but he did just an outstanding job of covering that topic. Because it's easy, when you're not in charge, to know exactly what to do until you're in charge. And then it's, that's not as easy as I thought. There are consequences for these decisions. So we're asking our young adults the question, we want you to be in charge. We look forward to you being in charge. But what will you do when you're in charge? And long story short, he boiled it down to the point, it's not a matter of what you'll do when you're in charge, it's who you will be when you're in charge. You just handle it extremely well. So once it's posted, we'll let everybody know. And if you'd like to listen to that, I just thought it was very well done. But I've been in that seat far too many times thinking that the answer is so obvious until then you find all the background and, oh, that wasn't nearly as obvious. And my great idea for a solution would only make things worse. I can see that now. So these individuals tend to speak evil of things they don't understand, and they don't take the time to understand. So they have no idea what the angelic realm is really all about, but they're speaking evil about church government, God's government, overall government, etc., etc. And again, it's easy to, on Facebook, to type evil about things you don't understand, people don't understand. I mean, everybody on Facebook can have an opinion. What do they say? Opinions are like belly buttons. Everyone has one. Except Adam, of course. But other than that, everybody, who cares what my opinion is? It's my opinion. Who cares? What difference does that make? What we want is truth. We don't want opinion. So in this case, they're like brute beasts. And we're right at close to an hour. So I'm going to go ahead and cut it off there. And because we would like to talk more about verse 13 and feasting with you and things like that, that will take a little bit more time. So we're at 57 minutes, so we'll go ahead and call it quits there and pick it up with verse 13 next time.